I'm Michael Provence. I teach Middle Eastern history at the University of California, San Diego. I recently sat down and had a long chat with Anthony Shadid. Anthony Shadid is a Pulitzer Prize-winning Middle East correspondent for the Washington Post. And he was shortlisted for a Pulitzer Prize connected with his coverage of the 2006 Summer War in Beirut. He spends most of his time in Lebanon, and we spoke about his experiences there, his impressions, his reflections on the war over the summer of 2006 and since in Lebanon. We talked for quite a long time and covered many areas of Middle Eastern politics and history and the United States' role in the region.
The war, the Lebanon War of 2006, you covered and spent some of your time. How did you manage to get into the South from Beirut, and what sort of things did you see on the way there?
You know, I think that was the real challenge in a way of covering that war was, in some ways just the logistics of it. How do you get to cities like Sur, or more importantly, Bint Jebel, and these kind of frontline villages that were so devastated by the Israeli attacks during that war? I think it required money to be able to pay people to actually take you down. And then once there, you had to find not only a place to stay and work, but also communications. You know, how can you get your story back to your editors? How can you get what you write into the newspaper in the end? And, you know, cell phones, of course, worked, but not always. We also had satellite phones. And this is just kind of the day-to-day, you know, making the journalism work, but it often represents 60-70% of the actual effort involved, is just in trying to cover the story itself. That was, you know, the Israeli army was very insistent on not letting us cover the story the way it should have been covered. And I think that just getting to a place like Bint Jebel, which, you know, even today is still pretty much devastated, it's almost destroyed in a way, was not impossible. We made it, but we made it, you know, one day out of how many, you know, more than 4 or 5 weeks, and that, you know, you could have spent the entire time in Bint Jebel, the entire war in Bint Jebel, and covered the war in a good way. We, of course, weren't able to do that.
You said something very interesting just now. You said the Israeli army was very insistent on preventing the free movement of journalists and the coverage of the war. So, I mean, the sort of infrastructure that was destroyed was clearly destroyed in order to limit that sort of movement and make it impossible to cover, you would say. I mean, how many journalists were down there? How many of your colleagues made it down there?
You know, there were quite a few journalists. It's tough to say, put numbers on it, because there were television journalists in another hotel, then there were mainly print journalists where I was staying. You know, there were probably a couple dozen of us. And just making those decisions of getting out and I hate these words, braving the roads, but, you know, taking the risks on the roads to get to these places was a decision you were, you know, going over and over in your head, you know, several times a day. There was one instance I remember that stands out when we were on the phone with the IDF, with the Israeli military, telling them that we were going to a village. There was a convoy of journalists going to this village, and, you know, we were in contact with them every 10, 15 minutes. They knew where we were. They obviously knew who we were. We drove along a road that was in full view of the Israeli military. I mean, this is a border road, and it was very exposed in a way. Got to the village, did about an hour of work. We knew we couldn't stay that much longer. And then on our way back, we were still shelled by the Israeli army, and one journalist was slightly wounded. Of course, that pales before everything else that happened in the war, but it does show you that, you know, there's almost I don't know if it would be a policy of harassment or a policy of just, you know, recklessness in dealing with journalists, but there was definitely very concrete steps taken to make the environment very inhospitable to having people witness what was going on in the South.
Bearing witness was something that journalists were having to risk their lives in order to do.
You know, I think it's one of the, you know, journalism is criticized often, and I think very legitimately criticized. I think that, you know, the profession has really failed in a lot of very substantial ways. But that notion of bearing witness, that notion of being there when, you know, for instance, civilians are killed in the war in Iraq, or Lebanese civilians are killed in the Israeli attacks that happened last summer. And I think that's one of the things that journalism can do well, and that has to do, you know, as part of its mission. It doesn't always do it. It doesn't always do it well. But when it does get it right, I think it is something that is worthwhile.
The you know, there were reportedly something like 25,000 Americans in Lebanon. You write for the Washington Post, for an American newspaper. The American government would have had us believe that all the journalists and all the American citizens, private citizens, whatever, in Lebanon were under threat, more from the forces of Hezbollah that are in those communities where they provide, you know, services and so forth within those communities, than the bombardment of the Israeli military. Did you find that to be the case? I mean, did you ever feel that you were threatened by Hezbollah forces? And I wonder if you could say, as a sort of a corollary to that, I wonder if you could say something about the social function that Hezbollah fulfills within those communities.
Yeah, I think it's a great point to make about the threat that, you know, that people faced in Lebanon last summer. And it struck me as a reporter in the villages in southern Lebanon doing the work, how different it was, say, than covering the war in Iraq, for instance. When dealing with the insurgency in Iraq was a very dangerous business. It was something that you'd have to think long and hard about before you wanted to do it, before you'd venture into a place like Anbar, for instance, or you'd go to Fallujah before the Americans destroyed it. It was such a different landscape, such a different environment in southern Lebanon. You know, Hezbollah knew we were there. They were they had informers in every village. They were keeping an eye on things. There was no question they knew we were there. But there was never a threat directed toward us in any way whatsoever as journalists in doing what we were doing. In fact, I'll never forget this one, to me, very memorable episode when it was me and a couple of other colleagues. We were in Sur, Tyre, in southern Lebanon, and we went to the Latani River. And the Latani is kind of in some ways the natural border of southern Lebanon. And Hezbollah, the fighters there, were resupplying their lines basically across the river. And it was a kind of a clandestine operation. They were trying to do it very quickly and somewhat haphazardly. They knew we were there, they knew what we were doing, and they let us watch it. And it was a striking show of sophistication in some ways. Yeah. That, you know, they understood that, you know, that coverage in some ways probably would benefit them, but they also had a certain respect for what journalism was supposed to be and what the role that journalism was going to play in any kind of war, or the role that journalists wanted to play in a war. And I was always struck by that. There's obviously, they had self-interest in doing what they did. You know, we also had an interest in watching what we did, and I thought it was a nice convergence and allowed us to do a story that wouldn't have been done otherwise, that I thought was important. You know, I think that goes to what the role of, in some ways, going off on a little bit of a tangent here, but the role that Hezbollah does play in the South. And if I can maybe turn to a little more personal direction, I'm working on a book right now in southern Lebanon, and I'm living in a village in an area that's pretty well controlled by Hezbollah. And it's always struck me how much the organization has become an organic part of the landscape. And I don't want to lionize them or anything like that. I'm not sure I'd want to live in a state that's controlled by Hezbollah, but you can't deny the organic role that they play in that landscape in terms of social services, in terms of welfare of the people, in terms of the connection they see themselves as having to the inhabitants of the region that they're working. And it is a deep connection. It's a connection that I think goes toward the community, the Shiite community's notion of itself, you know, decades of disenfranchisement and what Hezbollah represents in terms of empowerment. But I think it also goes toward the day-to-day livelihood of these people and the role that Hezbollah plays in bettering that situation. That's why I think it's so frustrating for a journalist sometimes when you deal with the American context and the Americans simply label it as a quote-unquote terrorist organization. When you're in the Lebanese context, you see this organization in its full form and how nuanced and complex, and in some ways ambiguous, it actually is.
Now, I mean, in those communities in the South where Hezbollah is fulfilling these kinds of functions socially, where is the Lebanese state, and what kind of things is the Lebanese state doing or not doing that makes people rely upon the services that Hezbollah has provided?
You know, this again, it's kind of a cliche, you know, that politics are local, but it always strikes me as a way to understand Islamic movements in the Middle East, you know, that politics are incredibly local. And when you look at the Muslim Brotherhood, for instance, in Egypt, or Hamas in Palestine, or very, you know, in some ways, in some spectacular ways, Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, they're answering a need that is left, you know, that is being left in the local landscape, usually by the absence of the government. And I think southern Lebanon is almost the most flagrant example of that, where southern Lebanon has basically been ignored by the state, you know, intentionally and unintentionally. You know, the civil war forced the Lebanese government to withdraw in some respects, but intentionally and unintentionally, the Lebanese government has abandoned the South for, you know, 30 years now, and Hezbollah entered that vacuum. And without it, it would have been an even more miserable landscape. I mean, it's already a poor landscape filled with hardships, but it would be much worse without Hezbollah there in terms of the hospitals, in terms of the payments and the social services. And I think also the sense, and I don't want to take this too far, but the sense, I think, of many of the inhabitants who live in southern Lebanon that they're not, that at least somebody is defending their interests, that somebody is working for them. And that's, I think that's an important notion sometimes, that you're not abandoned completely, that you do have a defender. And I think Hezbollah very consciously in some ways plays to that notion of defending the community, of defending the land, of defending the people who live there.
So the I mean, to characterize the Israeli and to a certain extent the American approach to policy in Lebanon specifically, where there's a kind of an argument that that Hezbollah is not a deeply rooted organization, but rather some sort of foreign implant that can somehow be that by war or by other policy initiatives, Hezbollah can be separated from the people by outside pressure, America, Israel, so on. This doesn't sound like you would consider this very credible.
Exactly. And I think that's, you know, I think there was a notion during that war last summer, and I think American officials were talking about it, that we'd see a repeat in some ways of the 1982 Israeli invasion, when the Israelis invaded Lebanon up to Beirut and the PLO. The Palestinians were driven out of the country. And, you know, that most iconic moment in 82 when Palestinian fighters were forced to get on the boats and leave the capital. I think there was a notion among American and Israeli policymakers that they were going to do a repeat of this just with Hezbollah. But it's one of those memories that's still so vivid to me, is sitting in the Washington Post Bureau in Beirut. I think it was the second or third day of the war, and Condoleezza Rice said, this war is going to end with the destruction of Hezbollah, or the dismantling of Hezbollah, or some notion along that, something along those lines. And I'll never forget, it's almost rolling my eyes, because I said, if their understanding, their lack of understanding runs this deep, then we're in for a very long war, because you simply don't remove Hezbollah from the Lebanese landscape. It's a very integral, a very organic part of that landscape, and one that's going to remain for at least a generation.
The Israelis, and to a lesser extent the Americans, actually thought that they were going to be able to somehow tear Hezbollah out of the society that it was rooted in, and send them packing in the same way that the Israelis had sent the PLO packing in 82, in the late summer of 82.
And I think that was their intention. I think that was their naivete. And, you know, you can almost see it with the Americans. I mean, with the Americans approached Iraq, for instance. I mean, it was such a superficial kind of understanding of what that country represented. But I've been baffled, and to this day I still don't understand how the Israelis would not understand the situation better. Their experience with southern Lebanon has run, you know, at least to 1978 when they first invaded the country. They've dealt with Hezbollah since its creation, almost after the Israeli invasion itself, and how they would still remain wedded to this notion that you could turn the rest of Lebanon against Hezbollah and that would be the end of the story. It's spectacular in some ways.
Yeah. Huh. I remember the flyers that were coming in the air, and turn away from these people who are against your nation and so on, signing the government of Israel.
And they would jam, I remember being down in southern Lebanon, they would jam Hezbollah's radio station and then broadcast the Israeli version of the news or whatever. And, you know, it wasn't even sophisticated. It was just this very kind of thuggish, you know, Nasrallah is hiding, your defender is hiding, you know, they're crumbling beneath the onslaught or whatever. I mean, it was just that if one person out of what, you know, a few hundred thousand was turned, I would be amazed. I just think it was so heavy-handed.
How can the level of misunderstanding be so great? I mean, it's a sort of a theme that unites, say, Iraq and Lebanon in a way, and sort of these early 21st century Middle Eastern conflicts somehow. But how is it that these people can be so ignorant of the actual situation in those countries?
You know, I'm going to kind of, you know, I think a lot of people would really disagree with what I'm about to say, but I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, I think both the United States and Israel, you know, the lack of humanity they read into their opponents, the lack of, I think there's a certain, is prejudice the right word? Is dehumanization? Is kind of a certain condescension that they bring to the table when they deal with their opponents. And I think this informs a lot of what's going on, that could we understand a very complicated, complex relationship between Hezbollah's constituency. I guess if we did, then we'd have to understand that this goes beyond just a simple notion of terrorism, or that there is something that would maybe motivate their actions, that is somehow legitimate, that is somehow worthwhile. I think to make that leap is a difficult one when you do have this, again, I'm missing the right word in particular, but this condescension, this dehumanization that goes on, and I think that informs pretty much their approach to all this stuff.